Socialism was being discussed before the House Judiciary Committee. I heard the present House Speaker let his hair down a lot more than I ever expected to hear about the abuses of the free conference system and why a lot of the rules of the legislature should be changed. It's a subject that probably gets a lot more debate than the potential for action on it might justify, simply because it's a subject we like to talk about. It's one that touches very closely on the legislature's accountability to the people. I understand the arguments about forming a unicameral legislature so there's a little bit less buck passing and that people have a greater handle on what their legislator is doing, and he's going to have to stand up and account for himself a lot more. But I also remember a comment after this was rather thoroughly discussed once in Juneau, a comment by Mr. Fink, who said that there's so many ways to fool the public that we'll find them out anyway, no matter what they do. I tend to agree with that. I think that ways will be found to get around improvements like this. The unicameralism arguments often revolve around abuses of the Free Conference Committee, and I don't notice too many references in this document to the Free Conference Committee. Those are all run by rules that could conceivably be changed. They're all run by procedures which could conceivably be bettered if people were interested enough in bettering them. In the time I've been in the legislature, I've seen a lot of bicycling of bills. Regular announcements of free conference committee meetings, except for verbal announcements on the floor of one house or another, if you happen to be there when they're announced. Very often they're not posted. Very often there's no meetings of a free conference committee at all. I remember situations where legislators might be appointed to two free conference committees in one day and not know about it until the bills are brought around to be signed. The two chairmen have gone and hashed it out somewhere. No standing membership of a free conference committee with which you can approach for an abuse. If the House Resources Committee does something continuously that a member of the public or the press is upset about, you can always go to the chairman and say, hey, you know, I don't want you guys doing this next week. If you say that to the free conference committee chairman, he's not going to be there next week. The legislature is probably going to be adjourned next week, and whatever you say about it is going to be the last thing people are interested in reading. There's no ongoing staff responsibility with a free conference committee, and quite often free conference committee actions are somewhat represent the worst that can happen in a legislature. However, there's no secret about this. As I said, people at this table have discussed it openly, and I've written about it openly, and I've never had people exactly buttonhole me on the streets and say, when are we going to clean up the free conference committee procedures? It's not an issue that breeds great excitement. It sort of touches home when somebody sees a bill that they wanted get shot down or a bill that they didn't like get concocted and passed in the last minutes of a session by a free conference committee, and that upsets them. But cleaning up the system doesn't seem to actually grip the imagination of the public. I don't particularly think that's a reason for unicameralism. It's a reason for concern about the way the legislature operates, certainly. But I wonder if accountability and simply some rules problems are a reason for a massive change of the Constitution. Mr. Bradner's comments about expanding the Senate were interesting. I've always wondered why the Senate had to be organized as a mirror image of the House, even though it had half as many people. With the Senate's reapportionment under U.S. Supreme Court decision, we have a body that is kind of a miniature mirror image of the House. It doesn't particularly have a character that distinguishes it from the House. And in that lie a lot of good arguments for unicameralism. If you want to change the constitution of the state simply to follow a Supreme Court decision, I think some of those problems can be addressed without exactly expanding the size of the Senate. Again, I've wondered why the Senate has the same number of committees as the House. It certainly puts them at a disadvantage because, as Mr. Radner pointed out, the House has 8 or 9 people who are all specialists on the budgets and all know the entire budget quite well. And the Senate has 6 or 7 people, most of whom specialize in a particular area of the budget, and only 1 or 2 of whom know the whole thing real well. And it leads it open to the House folding a free conference committee out from under the Senate like they did a year ago. And the Senate finds itself in an intense manpower situation. I sort of think perhaps there might be a way of changing the Senate's committee systems or a way of changing the Senate's representation so that it doesn't follow population lines as closely as it does now, but perhaps follows boundaries of geopolitical units and economic units and so forth. And I think that's something that could be addressed as we draw a little bit closer to the next time we reapportion the legislature. The generally, when we talk about changes to the Constitution, they're, with the exception of a grand sweeping change like unicameralism, when we talk about session limits or budget limits and things like that, we're talking about small changes. And I, as I've read this document several times since I started covering the government that it created, I get the feeling that the document is designed for an active public participation and observation. It's it creates a legislature and executive over which the public is meant to have a great deal of say and a great deal of interest. Sometimes in my profession, we get appalled when the public doesn't show this the type of interest we think in our own specialties they should have. It's true the sessions are long and more bills are passed. It's also true that the state's growing quite quickly and we have a burgeoning oil industry and so forth. And I think that if people were upset about the sessions being long and upset about a lot of laws being passed, they'd also be extremely upset if the legislature didn't address the problems of the oil industry and didn't address the problems of medical malpractice insurance and special features of Alaskan's workman compensation insurance and other things which I've seen the legislature spend a lot of time on. I think that if the public was highly upset about long sessions and about heavy legislative activity and about the government expanding into these areas of operations, then a lot of people sitting here might not have gotten reelected a long time ago, and a lot of people that are in the rest of the legislature would have had trouble going back. The public does send the same people back time after time. They give them a little ragging around every 2 or 4 years, but certainly my profession does its share to stir up the trouble against them. But I think that's healthy, and I think it's a better way to go about some of these reforms than perhaps rewriting a document which they consider to be a foundation upon which laws are changed and acted upon.
Thank you, Mr. Pratt. We reached the point in the morning program where the firmed bottoms of these chairs are moving us to a 10-minute break, if you will, and then we'll come back for questions among the group and questions from the audience. We try to be back in about 10 minutes after you have your stretch. Mr. McCutcheon, who is chairman of the Legislative Branch Committee. Mr. McCutcheon, do you have any comments to make on some statements made this morning or afterthoughts?
Oh, Mr. Chairman, I don't think I have any immediate comments to make. There's some remarks that have been observed here that I do have an interest in, maybe sooner or later, making answer to, but I think that for my part, I'd rather have the questions come from the interested parties in the audience here, as it may be, they may be even more perceptive than I on these different situations. So I think for my part, I would just as soon pass by and get into the questions that might arise from the audience, and maybe at a later time, if those my observations are still not covered, why then make some sort of a comment.
Thank you, Mr. McCutcheon, and you're still holding up your reputation for being a good politician. Representative Greening.
Well, that's a hard act to follow. I think I'm going to concur. I've got a plane to catch, too, at
right.
I believe in 25 minutes. So.
Mr. Pratt, you were the last. Do you have anything since the break?
I guess, I don't think I was any more enlightened than my previous attempt. I get to talk to all these guys quite a bit anyway, and so I'll pass over this chance.
All right, fine. Mr. Fink.
Well, a couple of comments. The having just unicameralism, we speak of an advantage being accountability, and I just don't see where there's any more accountability in unicameralism than there is in bicameralism. The idea that everybody's going to have to vote in front of everybody, it just doesn't happen. It isn't going to happen. Whatever accountability you can build into unicameralism, you can build into bicameralism. When I was Speaker, we did vote on pre-conference committee reports, recorded votes. When I was on the floor, whenever I wanted to record a vote, I got one. So I indicated in my original remarks, I feel that something is in order to correct the pre-conference committee, mainly because of credibility, but it isn't all that vicious. When we talk about a committee going off and settling something, well, how do you got to settle between two conflicting groups. You know, if you have a House take one position, Senate take another, or if you have unicameralism, you in effect would have probably 9 or 10 houses, what amounts to. If you only had committees in one house, each of those committees would have to work a compromise out between them, just like the houses do now. You can't get away from the fact that conflicting views are going to have to be resolved some way, and very often they can be better resolved in a committee of 6 people than they can on the floor with 60 people. Generally, you don't take a bill to the floor until you have a consensus on a bill, because it is just murder trying to get anything done. Now, the idea that I was pleased that various members of the panel indicated that they believe that maybe some kind of a deadline for the length of the session is in order, and I had indicated, Mr. Greening, that originally I was opposed to a deadline. I now think it is in order, because I think that too many people cannot go down there, and I think that because we have a group of people now who, and because the legislative pays up high enough, some people can afford to do it year-round, they're never in a hurry to end. And there are others of us who feel that the work of the state can be handled in 75 or 90 days. But it isn't, the length of the session depends really upon the people of the existing law that the people send to Juneau, to the Capitol. The leadership can do so much. The leadership, the second year when I was Speaker, we had 21 votes now on our side. That's the bare amount that you need to move anything. So you're constantly working out compromises in your own group to keep your 21 votes. Nevertheless, we were able, because we targeted at 90, I presume if we had targeted at 75, and we could have targeted at 75, except the attitude of the 40 members of the House and the 20 members of the Senate was not to target at 75. I'd love to have targeted at 75, and I think we could have done the job for that matter. But we targeted at 90, and one year we met it, and one year we were 5 days late. But the only reason we met it is because we targeted it. Now, I think in the last 10 years, with the way things have developed, that to expect the leadership to be able to pull together and get out of there in a decent length of time is expecting more than you're going to get. And that, for that reason, I would support a constitutional amendment on the, to limit it to 75 or 90 days, with an out clause where you could overrule it for 30 days. I don't think 90 days is going to cause any less review of legislation than we currently have. Now, I think Mr. Pratt may have mentioned he couldn't see why the Senate has as many committees as the House, and I think it may be an incorrect interpretation, but at least it's been the interpretation of the people in general that under Section 12 of the Article 2, both houses must have the same set of rules and the same number of committees. Now, that may be a wrong interpretation, but that's why it's that way. And when Mr. Bradner referred that we needed more people in the Senate if you're going to have as many committees, somewhere that does have to be balanced.
That's it, Jack.
Thank you, Mr. Fink. Speaker Bradner.
Well, if we really would like a short session, I think there's probably a simple answer. I think everybody recognizes in Alaska the nature of anybody's occupation means they usually have to be off at work during the summer season. And if we convene March 1st, I can assure you one way or another the membership would eat the leadership alive and want to be out of there by June 15th. And by the way, that's not a facetious statement, because you would have 2 months for some careful and more prudent executive budget planning, probably some budget planning by your finance committees. And the membership would be spared their personal financial hardship and business hardship from being there a prolonged period of time. But you don't see that suggestion brought forward. From a practical point of view, that would shorten a session. If we're talking about saving dollars, it'd save dollars. And it would escape the problem of an absolutely arbitrary deadline, which often could be used by special interest or by people in a leadership position who want to avoid certain issues. I would like to also discuss just briefly the relationship of the executive and the legislature. I think we have to acknowledge that our Constitution created an executive government that's the strongest in the United States of America, other than dictatorial governments of foreign nationals. It may be one of the strongest executive structures in the world. And we did that because we were tired of the disarray of executive function in territorial days. Now, if we showed that executive structure to people in other states and explained to them kind of the governments we have, which we frequently do when we meet our colleagues elsewhere, they're really shocked. And they say, how in the world do you prevent abuse when you give a man this margin of power? And of course, the answer to that, apparently, because the systems work very well in Alaska, is that the sheer accountability that you have thrust upon the governor as the singular responsible entity, that singular accountability has prevented abuse. Because the questions and answers clearly have to come from the governor, and he can pass the buck nowhere else. Our judiciary was also cast in a very streamlined mold, one that a lot of other states would like to emulate. The legislature, while it was given some substantial improvements, was left substantially in the operational mold of other legislatures. The question that's been in some legislators' mind is if the legislature can develop the strength to match that super strong judiciary and that executive. This also has brought about the search for accountability. Not saying unicameralism is necessarily the answer, but the feeling that you're not just talking about accountability within the legislature, saying, well, gee, I know who voted on a certain bill and who's responsible. But accountability in the legislature being a spokesman in debate with the executive on major issues that are before the state. Right now, you very rarely see the press coming and saying, well, Speaker Bradner, Governor Hammond has done this. What do you think about that? Or President Croft, or the chairman of the Finance Committee. I would suggest those issues really are lost and submerged in the confusion of bicameralism. I think some of us who have served in the legislature get an uneasy feeling that we see Republicans fighting Democrats, liberals fighting conservatives, the legislature fighting the executive, the House fighting the Senate, and our energy is consumed in those fights, and we get a suspicion that there's an area where a large amount of our policy is made, which is in the bureaucracy, not by elected officials at all. And this is where I am somewhat concerned about the operating efficiency of the legislature, its ability to be an effective check on the executive branch, and also a policeman of that very strong executive structure, where there is the danger that the bureaucracy can be making decisions. And I seriously question whether the legislature in 60 days or 90 days, perhaps in 120 days, in this day and age of the kind of money we have coming into the structure and the kind of government we're operating, can police a budget. And of course, efficiency and fiscal responsibility is a big issue today. And if it is, then we had best be concerned about creating the legislature in a mold in which it can be a knowledgeable policeman of those interests. And I question whether we're doing a very good job of it today.
Thank you, Speaker Bradner. I want to ask you a question. Was that mention you made of the limited session a public request for a pre-filed bill, or?
Not quite.
I missed a chance for a little business there. We now want to have an opportunity for all participants in this section to ask questions, and because we're being recorded for posterity by the university, we request those asking questions to go to either aisle, to go to the microphone, and identify themselves as they wish, as you are being recorded in time here, and to direct the question to anyone on the panel you wish. If there is a question regarding the obvious merits of the legislature's staff, I'd be glad to answer those directly. Now, is there anybody who would like to ask any member of the panel a question on the legislative operation and procedures? I see over there the hand of Delegate Helen Fisher.
My name is Helen Fisher, and it wasn't clear to me, you all talked about it, but in the Free Conference Committee report, I have always felt that the Constitution called for a recorded vote and that it had to pass by the same type of margin that it would have to, that a bill would have to pass, because it is a final bill. And yet, I've gone through session after session, and this has not happened. Now, would someone clarify to me, and I was a member of Steve's committee, and this was my contention at the time that we wrote that document, and yet, unless it's just utter abuse on the part of the legislature, but if I could explain just a little bit more, and I'm not trying to give a grandstand play here, believe it or not, John, I'm not. But I saw a bill, I'll just take one instance, come up before the legislature last year, a Free Conference Committee report. It wasn't on our desk. It was one of the last minutes, you know, everything comes piling in the last minute. And the person that explained, which was the majority leader, said the only thing that we've added in this bill was to give additional money for people of low income for rental, which everyone positively agreed with. Well, it wasn't until the governor had signed the bill, until it came out in the paper, that there was another thing in it, that over 65 taxes were going to be put on people over a certain amount. Now, that was never mentioned on the floor. This is what I'm saying about the Free Conference Committee report. People voted on that. They didn't know what they were voting on. I didn't know what I was voting on, because I thought I was voting on the original bill plus this addition for those that could not afford the rent, the high rents in Anchorage, which I was in perfect agreement with. So, and yet it is not a recorded vote. It was just one of those yays and nays. And people didn't know what they were voting on. And I wonder if it's even constitutional to, and that's what I'd like to know from you, whether you feel that it's constitutional to have a free conference committee report come to the floor without a written document on your desk explaining everything and also a vote on it. By a majority of the House and of the Senate.
I think it might be useful if we ask Mr. McCutcheon to give us his remembrance of any discussion at the Council Convention, then maybe ask Speaker Bradner and others to comment on that.
It was the intention of the committee, at least, and I'm sure the total convention, that the record must be written on every law that was considered in final passage. As far as the report being connected with a free conference committee report coming out with an explanatory thing, that would be, in my estimation, one of the rules of the houses. But as far as final passage, no matter what form that passage takes, it has to be recorded. That was our intention, because we wanted to have people accountable for their vote, so that the public could go to this person or that person and say, you voted for this bill and I don't like it. Why'd you do it? It was the intention of the convention to make the legislators accountable. And that's why it's written specifically in there that on the final passage of the document, it shall be yea and nay by name.
Mr. Chair, I would like to speak also on this subject as one of the delegates.
This delegate, Yule Kilcher.
Yeah. I wholeheartedly agree with Delegate McCutcheon's opinion brought up by Delegate Fisher. Personally, among many other things that happened during the last 20 years, I think that any law on the books now that did not conform to the standards mentioned by Mr. McCutcheon is not a law, is illegal, unconstitutional, and could be contested in the Supreme Court. I'm perfectly convinced. In fact, I know about cases that are preparing and cooking right now. They're being hatched based on this position, and I can only endorse it. I have a few other remarks later on about the unicameralism, but this just to the subject brought up by Delegate Fisher.
Thank you, Mr.
Kilcher. John, you or I, ought to explain at least what the ruling has been in the legislature. And I don't know where all it came from. When I was Speaker anyway, it was an established rule, and I didn't really contest it. But we did take votes on the Free Conference Committee, I believe, in every case when I was Speaker, I believe. I might be wrong. But in any case, a bill is passed in each House on a recorded vote. Then that bill goes into conference, and some changes are made, and it comes back to both floors. And the interpretation has been is the changes that are made by the Free Conference Committee are amendments, and that the bill did pass with a recorded vote when it originally passed each House. That's the legal interpretation. It passed originally by a recorded vote, and then when the Conference Committee completes, it's an amendment. Now, it has been customary, and no one's talked about that today, that amendments generally are handled in second reading on a voice vote. Again, sometimes they're recorded. But they also may be, I don't think anybody contests that amendments may be handled on a voice vote, and a Free Conference Committee report has been treated as a voice vote. I agree with the speakers that the Free Conference Committee bills ought to be recorded, but I want to comment why the legislature has taken the position they have complied. It's on advice of counsel that we have complied. Now, whether or not it's constitutional, I guess I don't know.
Speaker Bradner.
Several different questions here. One is the recording of votes. The other principal measure is what is a Free Conference Committee report? Any addition in that report is the simple addition of one word, perhaps simply clean up language. Does that constitute a new bill, or is that an amendment? Now, our Constitution also provides that a bill must go through three separate readings. And the problem that the courts have had to contend with, and the reason that the courts have ruled that free conference committee material is amendments, was because of the can of worms that are opened up trying to determine through all these shades of material as to when one word or perhaps a whole new bill becomes substantially a new bill. And I think the courts, in essence, probably looked at it and said, we're going to have 10,000 different cases brought before us, so we're going to have to treat this material as amendments. And for that reason, this had to do with the number of votes that were required for the adoption of Free Conference Committee report. It also carried with it the interpretation that it could be done on a voice vote, exactly as an amendment in second reading. Now, if the court should come back and say any material added in a Free Conference Committee report is a new bill, then that interpretation would also have to apply to any amendment that was offered in second reading, and it would again have to go back and go through three readings. So these are some of the reasons why the court has treated addendum language and free conference committee as amendments and not as a new bill. It's really because of the subsidiary confusion. As far as recording a voice vote, I think in the last legislature, anybody who wanted a voice vote usually got it on a free conference committee report. Any eight hands in the House, in fact, can insist on a roll call vote on any motion. And for the most part, I think legislatures in recent years, the past four or five, have done a very good job of trying to get the material on members' desk. It is true as an individual member, it's very hard to keep up with that material and make sure that you understand what's there. And sometimes perhaps something appears in a bill that you didn't know about and proves embarrassing.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. What the Speaker was alluding to is that this question of what is a Commerce Committee report, an amendment or a report you're adopting, is currently in litigation. We hope soon to have a decision regarding what the court now thinks it is, and may give us some guidance in the future. Are there further comments or questions? Mr. Erickson, do you care to go to the microphone?
As a constitutional conservative, at least, I'm concerned with the, well, first of all, we've been told in our past, previously, that our Constitution is a real solid rock foundation, and it cannot be very capricious, or will not be capriciously changed because of its soundness. However, I notice that there are four proposals to amend the Constitution in coming up in the ballot in November, and additional two of them, those were proposed by the legislature, and two of them are initiated propositions. Now, my fear is that there'll be a tendency, and it is indicated here, to change the Constitution by amendment rather capriciously, because there will not be sufficient time or consideration for dialogue and for debate. The open entry proposition, for example, I gather that it was rather hurriedly put through in the legislature and voted upon by the people two, 3 years ago, and now there are second thoughts about it. And now here is the one on the unicameral legislature again, and the one on the education matter that will not sharpen, but do the opposite of the difference between public education and private education, open the way for private education to get public funds. So my point is, why should we not consider a constitutional amendment which will provide for a waiting period and a longer discussion period before we vote on these important issues, which we may, if we hurriedly adopt them, have second thoughts in a few years and have to reject them? I'd like to get the comments of any of you that are considered that situation.
Now, if I again mention the ground rules on constitutional amendments, you cannot start a constitutional amendment by initiative. There's no provision for it. Now, there's an advisory vote on a possible amendment, but the point is the constitutional amendments can only occur in one of two fashions. One is a constitutional convention, which, and that their results would be approved by the public subsequently. Or two-thirds of each House must approve a joint resolution, which then goes to the voters for approval. So, well, I wanted to mention that. You can't go the initiative route on constitutional changes. It's a significant part, I think, of the Constitution, that, and one that one could very well debate whether we ought to be able to change it by initiative or not.
Ms. Burke, like to go to the microphone?
I'm Carolyn Berg, and I'm a correspondent law student. And this has led me into a rather interesting field. First of all, I would like to comment about a couple of things that I would like to see the legislature do. And one of them is not to keep two sets of books. And I mean by that, make your legislation say what it means. And not so that when the people read a law, they don't have to go to another book to see what you really meant. I would like this adopted because I think the people, you know, most of the people read the laws and they really trust the legislature and they really feel that that's the law. When in effect it isn't. There's the law is in another book of your real intention. So I think this is one of the most serious things. I think that the people should, when they read a law on the books, that should be the promise that you should keep to the people. Now, another thing I would like to see is that our regulations reviewed, because there are many regulations that are really just overburdening to the citizen. And I think it is the purpose of the legislature to look into these old laws and these regulations to see that they're proper, isn't it? I mean, the legislature gets up laws and it also gets rid of the old laws that are really no good at all. And this, I think, is another very important process. Looking at the laws that we already have that are out of fashion or old-fashioned or really not working. Now, what I really want to say, and mainly, is this amendment to the Constitution of the United States. In studying the law, I started looking into how we do this. Well, Congress puts out a joint resolution, I understand, and then if it is passed and the president signs it, then it goes to the states, and the states so-called ratify it. And Mr. Fink just mentioned that the legislature votes on it, and then it goes to the people. Now, is this mandatory in our Constitution? If it isn't, it should be, because the people should have a chance to vote on that legislation. Now, we're stuck right now with an unconstitutional United States amendment, and that's Amendment 25. This amendment is completely unconstitutional, and it's called a so-called ratified amendment, and it's no amendment at all. Congress put
like
in this.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to answer those questions, but I have a plane to catch. May I be excused? I've really enjoyed this, and I thank you for inviting me.
If you'd submit him in writing, Mr. Green,
okay.
We appreciate it. Thank
my
you
resignation
kindly.
Is accepted.
Thank you for being with us. Sorry, Mrs. Berg, he has to leave.
Well, Congress put through this 25th Amendment, sponsored it, which says that we may appoint a president and vice president. And this wasn't the intention of our founders. Article 2, the 25th Amendment is unconstitutional and in conflict with Article 2, which says the president and vice president be elected. It doesn't say be appointed. Now, this takes away our vote. It takes away the chance of the sovereign citizen to vote for his president. The second part of Article 2 says, but no senator or representative or other person in high trust shall be appointed an elector. That means a voter. Well, when Congress introduced the 25th Amendment and Richard Nixon appointed Gerald Ford, they appointed themselves electors. And the 25th Amendment is unconstitutional upon its face.
John, we're really talking about the federal constitution.
Yes, Ms. Berg, we appreciate your comments, and there's others who wish to ask questions, that we do appreciate your observations on the federal constitution, but we are concerned with the legislative article of the state constitution as adopted now in use.
And, well, this is really serious as far as I'm concerned. I really want to
Ms. Berg, we agree it is serious and merits discussion, but we have other people interested in talking about the subject of this workshop. And I do appreciate your expression of the concern.
Jack, this is for a review.
Point of order, please.
Yes, sir.
Point out the fact that the sheriff has requested that we stay on the subject domain of the legislative branch. Would you please yield the floor to delegates, former delegates of this committee, so that we can discuss the program at hand?
What is your name?
George Cooper, a delegate to the Constitution.
Mr. Cooper, I would like to take exception to the fact that I'm not a member of the legislature, because I am. We're a member of the legislature, and I can point to the 282 petition in Washington State, which says each citizen is a member of the legislature.
Mrs. Berg, would you be good enough to yield? We do have other delegates and guests that would like to talk, and this is maybe not on point. And we would appreciate if you would yield and allow them to speak on the subject before this workshop.
Well, I will, but I would like to state that I am a member of the legislature, just a very important member, because a sovereign citizen is a member of the sovereign lawmaking body, and each one of us is. Now, I would like to pose my question. Is it mandatory that United States amendments go to the people for voting in our state of Alaska?
No.
As Mr. Fink mentioned.
Is
that
no,
mandatory?
Ma'am. No, and thank you. And Mr. Cooper, do you wish to have some
answer? Yes, I wish to address the panel.
Thank you.
This morning during the presentations, it was interesting that Mr. Fink commented, particularly on the subject of veto, that at times he can't get the two houses together. Incidentally, under the Constitution, Article 2, Section 16 requires that they immediately go into session together to review veto. To Mike Bradner, the reference of deterioration of the partisanship politics, I'm very much in agreement. The strong two-party system is the first step to a stronger check and balance in our form of government. Therefore, is it not possible that a bicameral legislature is a somewhat self-correcting system for this check and balance loss, if any, of partisanship politics? I did have one other point. I took exception to the Representative Green's statement. He's not here to defend this. He made it very clear, however. I do not see that the check and balance should not apply within a branch. It definitely should apply within a branch, not be just separated out only between the branches of government. It's another check and balance.
Mr. Bradner, do you wish to respond?
Well, I think I would agree that certainly with the deterioration of perhaps what you might call checks and balances within one body. The bicameral system supplies some protection. I think the question still remains, as the policy participation of legislating is expanded, which I think it has been in the past 20 years and will be in the next 20 years, with a great many public advocacy groups and other kind of structures growing up, I think we have to consider their participation and what they offer in the check and balance system, because this is a totally new dimension of government, which I think probably a lot of us did not conceive of in the past.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Rode?
Jim Rode. In recent years, there have been mounting clashes between the legislative branch and the executive over the governor's handling of appropriations. Governors of both parties have claimed that they can impound funds and transfer funds more or less at will, so that they almost claim the power to remake the budget, or so it seems to some. I was particularly wanted to know from Mr. McCutcheon, did the Founding Fathers see this as a problem?
Mr. Rhodes, yes, I'm sure that we clearly saw this problem. At least we argued considerably on the floor about the real clear-cut divisions between the two, between the three branches of our government. On the one hand, we gave the legislature a free hand in its operation. We didn't shackle it with a limited time. It could self-start if it needed to be. It could appropriate as it pleased. And on the other hand, we needed some entity which could veto this particular thing. And that's why in the executive branch, there is this line veto, this reduction of appropriation, a striking in the appropriation. And that is why the legislature has to override that veto with 75%. Now, as far as the impoundment of funds is concerned, is a matter that's not covered in this document, and I don't think it's a proper matter to cover in the document. The governor has his position of rejecting appropriation, so to speak, if he desires to. But once to impound the fund, after the legislature may have overridden his veto, I think is beyond his power. Now, I don't think that thing was specifically covered in the Constitutional Convention, but we certainly discussed all the facets of the checks and balances between the executive branch and the legislative branch with relation to the money. There needed to be a balance in it, and that's the way we arrived at it. Now, for the executive branch and the legislative branch to iron out how this is going to proceed may require the Supreme Court to intervene. Whether or not the governor, under his authority in the executive article here, has the privilege of impoundment after the legislature has once overridden his veto. I would say, prima facie at least, the governor does not have the right to impound. It might be an executive decision in the face of stringency of finances as far as the state was concerned, if we were totally out of money and the legislature had appropriated some millions of dollars that would appear to him to be frivolous, then another question arises. That would be a question of morality, perhaps. But here, I think this gives both houses the ability to control, or both the branches, the ability to control the other to a certain extent. But the legislative branch is the primary branch of the people. And that is the one that should have the final say in the funds. If the governor doesn't agree and vetoes, and the people's branch says, we override your veto, then I think the authority of the legislature is plain, and the governor has no further right to interfere.
Any other member of the panel has wished to comment on the executive impoundment of funds? Mr. Bradner.
I think probably the Alaska Constitution is rare in giving a very strong line item veto to the executive branch. And as a member of the legislature, I can't help but feel that If an executive is given the power of line item veto and he's given the time frame in which to use it, to me that carries an implication that you would have expect a very conservative decision, I think, from a court on the question of impoundment, because you can't have both. The governor has his time period after the legislature adjourns to express his line item veto. That's an extraordinary power, and it would appear that he should use that power and express it to the public in a constitutional manner, and simply not wait until that time period has been exhausted and then proceed with impoundment of funds. I think this gets at the question that Mr. Rhodes suggested. In fact, we found that situation in the last year or so when the governor bypassed his opportunity for line item veto and then wished to go through a systematic impoundment.
At one point, I wonder, Mr. McCutcheon, if you would comment on the other part of my question about the transfer of funds. You know, on the one hand, people argue that the governor has to have a great deal of discretion. On the other hand, the legislature is concerned that once they have laid emphasis on some part of the budget or want an agency to go in a new direction, that they should have that preference honored.
The matter of transfer of funds is strictly a function of the of the legislative branch. It may, as you say, the governor may want to transfer funds. This is a matter, I don't believe, that was covered in the Constitutional Convention. At least if it was, I can't remember it. The point was that the guidelines were set up for the three branches to function. If the legislature is specific in their designation of the funds for purposes, then the only thing the governor can do is to veto it because he doesn't agree. But I don't believe that he could interfere in the legislative process by taking something arbitrarily from here to there. That, of course, is my personal opinion. But as far as the Constitutional Convention is concerned, I don't recall that we ever discussed this particular type of thing because this is strictly a matter of function of the legislative process.
One who beats, I guess you're going to get there first, Roland. So I guess you.
Roland Armstrong, delegate. I want to speak to Fred Pratt a minute because I've just come through Ketchikan, Sitka, Juneau, Anchorage, and in here. And having been outside for 10 years, this is my third trip back. I didn't have this type of thing on my agenda, Fred. I have a growing concern in all that I've heard. Well, let me state it another way. I found a very healthy reaction to our Constitution. I found very few people that felt there had to be any amendments. They did feel, though, that within the legislative actions, there was a growing bureaucracy to support federal funds to be administered, you know what I'm talking about, to get a federal buck, why you had to put up so much money so that probably get down to the individual getting about 2.5 cents of the whole thing. This is not covered in the Constitution. The organization, the building of the bureaucracy. Where does the press for the health of our legislative branch in keeping the balances in these things so that we don't continue to build and have a growing cadre of people on top who are not elected but have tremendous power? How do we get this to the people? I didn't mean to stop you cold like that. It seems to me there has to be, within all of this, the action of the press and the communications section to bring these things to the people. Where are we in Alaska at this point?
You touch on a great issue, and it's an issue that's hard to articulate on, especially for someone who's covering day-to-day upcomings in public affairs. For someone who covers government, you go to a meeting of the such and such committee in the legislature and they take up this particular bill, and you spend most of your time doing what the government does or following their lead on the issues that they tackle. It's I've always found it hard as a member of the press to actually raise an issue and get people wildly excited about something that other people weren't getting them interested in as well. I think there's a lot of people that are concerned about the growing power of the bureaucracy. I was ruminating through my mind on the comments of the governor's power to impound or transfer funds. There's a credible power among the state bureaucracy to simply not spend funds. I've had a lot of legislators say this to me, that you know, we appropriated so many million dollars for this and that, but the guys in that department just aren't spending it. You know, they're just sending it back or shifting it around or doing something else with it. I'm not a legislator. I'd be at a loss to how to approach that legislatively. I'd like to see a greater dialogue about it in the public. It's a hard issue to grasp. If you're somebody sitting around a newsroom and you say, well, I'm going to go out and do a story on this, I think the efforts that were made by the finance committees in the last legislature toward a very systematic review of the each bureaucratic agency and how they worked are a good direction towards this. And in the situation I was in when I was in Juneau, I was able to spend a lot of time in the finance committee meetings, and I learned a lot of horrifying thing, and I think I printed quite a bit from it. But it's basically an issue that's presented statistically, and it's an issue that is bound up with a growing importance of special interest groups in the way our government functions, because each member of the bureaucracy who has a niche carved out for himself generally also has a constituency among special interest groups that either got him that niche or want him to keep it there. And until some other manifestation of the public's opinion, like stronger, more active political parties or new political organizations like we see springing up around the state, get more active, I don't see much of a legislative remedy for this. I'd be at a loss to, maybe somebody else on the panel could suggest how to approach it constitutionally. I'm not a person who can write laws as well as I can write a news story covering it, but it's an issue that I think can be addressed from primarily a legislative standpoint.
Speaker Bradner.
Delegate Armstrong touched upon the problem of federal funds and what this does to our system, and I think most legislators would agree that the handling of incoming federal funds is probably one of the most serious finance questions which we face, because this is an area where agencies receive federal funds, their budget is in essence expanded, often unbeknownst to the legislature, and we found ourselves committed to efforts and programs of which we had very little policy directive in creating. I think it's one of the most serious questions between the legislature and the executive branch today. It also has to do with the impoundment question and the shifting of funds question that was suggested by Mr. Rhodes. And it is probably that area which I touched upon earlier, where the legislature suspects that a great majority of policy is in fact being made in the bureaucratic structure without a broad range of policy input. Now, the legislature says we should appropriate the federal funds like any other funds. The executive branch says no, that's purely an executive function. And it's an area of dispute between the branches.
Delegate Sundborg.
I'm George Sundborg, and I was one of the founding fathers who have been mentioned here. I want to talk about something. I don't have a question on it, but I'm sure the panel will want to comment on my comment. And Tom, I think maybe this is a biggie. You know, you've often heard, every legislator I'm sure has heard, you can't legislate morality. And I think perhaps a corollary of that is you can't constitutionalize responsibility or conscientiousness. As we met here 20 years ago, I think each of us felt that the quality of legislators who would serve the state whenever it became a state would be somewhat on a level of that of the quality of the delegates who served in the Constitutional Convention, and that the legislature would be no less devoted to the public weal. I know it's dangerous for an outsider, and I'm not talking about one who lives outside of Alaska so much as one who does not serve within the legislature. It's always dangerous to try to pontificate about what should be done. It's so much easier to criticize than it is to get in there and do the work. But I have a feeling that there is a growing condemnation of the legislature of the state of Alaska. Some of it may be deliberately pumped up. The image of the legislature is not a good one. Maybe this is in the nature of legislative bodies. The image of the United States Congress is not a very brilliant one among the people of the United States. And I fear that criticism of the legislature is going to be the vehicle with which perhaps predatory interests are going to try to dominate the future of Alaska. I think you have to deal not only with the actuality of the situation, which you as legislators know, but in a democracy you have to deal with the public and the voter perception of what is going on in the state capitol. And that's extremely important. I don't blame the press in any way for this attitude, which seems to be becoming rather prevalent in Alaska, that the legislature has let us down. But I think there are some things that the legislature itself needs to do to improve its image and to improve its performance. I have been here for most of this week. I've been here all of this week, and I've taken some of my time to review the proceedings of the Constitutional Convention on one problem, and that was the problem of the level of legislative salaries. I believe the Alaska legislature, in the eyes of the voters of Alaska, is condemned more for the level of the salaries which they have attempted to vote themselves than for any other issue that they handle. And there are many much more important issues than that that they do handle. But in our Constitution, we provided at first that the salary of legislators should not exceed 10% of the salary of the governor. We didn't want to put an actual figure in and say it couldn't go above a certain number of dollars, but we thought that as the salary of the governor went up with changing times, which we could not entirely foresee, that the legislature should not be entitled to draw more than 10% of that, each member of the legislature. And attempts were made to change this to 20%, and that was defeated, and to 15%, and that was defeated. And it stood at 10% when we got very close to the final action on the legislative article, when this provision was eliminated. That is, and it was eliminated by a vote of only 27 to 25 with three absent. So I think that in the eyes of the delegates who were assembled here, we felt that the legislature should put some restraints upon itself in the matter of salaries. We delegates, if this might be of interest to you, and maybe many of you know it, Our salary for serving here in the Constitutional Convention was $1,125. And we met for 75 days, and we worked very hard. And we got, in addition to that, only $20 per diem. I don't know what the per diem level is now, and I'm not completely up to date on what the salary level of legislators is, but I know that it is criticized by some...